Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at Hume Fog.
You're far away. Oh, look, and there's the microphone. Hello, Nashville. I'm going to tell you a story about how I met Pat Conroy, because it's a very moving story to me. And actually, I think it is one that you'll remember. But it was 1994 in Oxford, Mississippi, at some Mississippi book festival thing. And I was there for my second novel, Taft, a book that sold, I think, 8 copies outside of my immediate family. And you stood in line, and you were it. You were just the it beyond it. And you were there with your dad. And I met your dad. You were doing the Pat and Dad show.
I'm so sorry.
And we have so much to talk about. And John Berendt was there, who wrote Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, because he was writing a profile about you for Vanity Fair. This was a very, very big deal. And you stood in my line and opened up the book, bought the hardback book, and said, you know, would you sign this? My name is Pat Conroy. Nothing like that ever happened again. That was a huge, huge deal. Then about 6 years ago, I was at Duke at another one of those things, and I was with Bob Butler, and I was meeting him for dinner, and we were in a hotel lobby, and I came across the lobby, and Bob was talking to you, and Bob said, do you know Pat Conroy? And I said, no, I'm Ann Patchett. And you said, I know you. I stood in your signing line in Oxford, Mississippi in 1994 and bought your novel, Taft. And you said, but you weren't Ann Patchett then, were you? You're good, mister. That was very meaningful. So now I get to say thank you. We're really, really glad you're here. And because I am starting book tour on Monday, and this is Pat's Pub Day. This is a huge deal. It's a huge deal that he's here, and it's a huge deal that he's here on Pub Day. So.
The one thing I told my publicist at Doubleday when the book was coming out is I've been reading about Ann Patchett. Her bookstore, Parnassus, is a bookstore, an independent bookstore. And I said, the one place I must go, and I have to go, and I want to go, and I will go, is to Parnassus in Nashville, Tennessee.
Wow. And thank you.
First of all, because I want to support independent bookstores, wherever they are. And the second is I'd like to just stare at Ann Patchett for about a night.
We can make all your dreams come true, Pat. How are you feeling about book tour? And I really, them aside, I need to know, how is this, how will this be? How has it been?
You know, it's, book tours are very strange to me. You know, book tours are, you know, I meet you all tonight, and I have my mother on my right shoulder. Hi, y'all. And I hear my mother saying, look them all in the eyes, son. Make sure you ask them where they are from. Ask them one question about themselves. Pretend that you're interested, even if you're not. And so my mother's good manners always comes into tours for me. And I like that. I'm glad that happens. And you also get to meet your readers for the only times in your life. I can't do the... I understand I have a Facebook page. I do not know how to get on Facebook.
No, I've never looked at Facebook, and I don't want to.
I just don't even know how to do it.
No.
And I've got, someone told me he had a Twitter account. You know, I don't even know what that is. So the way that I connect with readers is, you know, times like this, when, you know, when I can't see them, yet I know they're out there, and I know, you know, and they will tell me about what they're reading, and I will tell them about, you know, what I've been writing. And I like that connection you have with your readers on these tours.
Talk a little bit about going on tour with your dad, because it'll get us to where we're going, talking about your book.
Where I was with Dad?
No, about going on tour. That's just so weird. You went on tour with your dad.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah. No. If I gave that correction, I was wrong. My father went on tour with me.
You know what? Forgive me. You're absolutely
and
right.
And what would happen if you and I were talking here tonight? You would see a hulking figure in the background that would appear on stage. He'd break in and figure out a way to come out and sit there to join the conversation. And eventually, he would take over the conversation. But I got moved when the great Santini came out, and he hated that book with his body and soul. He hated everything about it. He hated my portrait of him as a father, as a husband, as a Marine. He loathed that book. But I was attacked by his family enough that as I was signing the great Santini, and you know those first books you just mentioned, you know, I had, I think, 12 intergalactic sales during that season. But I noticed Dad would come and sit beside me. And he got in the habit of signing my books with me. Now, for Dad, he would sign this way with the great Santini. I certainly hope you enjoy my son's work of fiction. And he would underline fiction. He'd underline fiction 5 or 6 times. And he said, my son certainly has an extraordinary imagination. And he would sign, oh, lovable, likable Don Conroy, the great Santini himself. This is kind of normal for the great Santini. He did it for every book I wrote after that. Bless. One time I had a big signing in Charlotte of 4 or 5 hours. Dad was beside me the whole time. And I got to translate this way, and it may be wrong. I thought it was my father, who was an inarticulate man with love. It was his way of telling me he loved me. Because when the Prince of Tides came out, and I said, Dad, what are you signing the Prince of Tides for? And my father, in his great modesty, said, I am the seed, son. I am the source. And I said, Dad, you sound like it's a cattle food shop. But it was his way of participating in a creative event that I came to appreciate very much.
Well, I guess that's what I want to know. Did you come to love having him there? Was it okay, ultimately, that he was there?
He made that okay with his, I've never seen a guy change because of a work of fiction. But I think Dad made an effort, and my mother divorcing him at the same time. And, you know, my father, now here's my father. Okay, son. And I went to talk with Dad, and I said, Dad, and he's weeping, which Dad never did. He's weeping, oh, I've got divorce papers from your mother. And he's crying. We're at Manuel's Tavern in Atlanta. He's weeping and crying. And I said, Dad, do you see what you did wrong now? Do you understand what you did wrong? And poor Dad going, yeah. And I said, what do you think it was, Dad? He said, I was way too easy on your mother and the kids. I should have cracked down harder. And I look at him from across the table. I said, Dad, Caligula couldn't have cracked down harder. And he said, no, this is, He goes to the judge. My mother has given the judge a copy of The Great Santini and said, "It's all here, Your Honor." My mother and sister testified on scenes in The Great Santini I had invented, I had made up. So, and Dad gets up in court, and this is in Beaufort, South Carolina, he says, "You cannot divorce me, Judge." And so the judge, rather surprised, said, "Oh, really, why not, Colonel?" "Because I am a Roman Catholic." And when the family hear this, we all... And he said, "I was married forever. And this court has no power to divorce me and Peg." He was divorced about 5 minutes later. But it was Dad. It was that, you know, that Marine, hard-charging guy that never changed.
When you sat down to write The Death of Santini, did you go back and read The Great Santini again?
No. I found it too painful.
I can't read any of my own work. I can't.
And I just thought, you know, and I think, first of all, I think, how did this get published? This stinks. But also...
No, you didn't read it. How do you know? We read it. We really liked it.
And I just didn't, you know, and I've been attacked about it within my family so much, you know, that I know where I screwed up with them. And it's in my father's family from Chicago, Irish. Holy God. You know, they have hated that book and hated that book. But I didn't need to. You know, those things, you know, I remember my first memory. They, you know, one of these little things they get us to do all the time, like pin.
Yeah.
You know, they,
yeah.
Penn had me go up with a thing, and it was 5 minutes, your first memory. My first memory was of being in a high chair, and I was in a base in El Toro. And I remember my father beating my mother, backhanding her to the floor, with her trying to stab him with a butcher knife. And I remember my face, my whole baby face, inflamed, and I had, you know, I didn't know how to talk then. And what it was inflamed with, I later realized, was hatred. And I didn't know there was an English word for hatred. So I didn't have to go back for that. That is always with me. That lives with me every day. You know, don't have to do research on it, study it. It is there.
Well, I'll tell you what's interesting. Because to do this, I read Prince of Tides, Great Santini, Death of Santini in a row. To get up to speed, I hadn't read Great Santini since, you know, I was in college. It's a remarkably mild book. I think you would be surprised. The violence... In that book is nothing compared to The Prince of Tides, and nothing compared to Death of Santini. I think you really soft-sold it.
Here's what happened to me on that hand. And, you know, why it is such a penetrating question and a troubling one. You know, I've had great editors in my life, starting with Shannon Ravenel, Jonathan Galassi, Nan Talese. I had an interim editor named Ann Barrett, who I think was in her 80s when she took it. And you have never seen, she looked like a figure that would go to a baseball game with Marianne Moore. I mean, she just had that look. I would write her these things, and instantly she would write back, "Pat, no one will believe this character. He's too mean. He's too horrible. You know, he's not believable, and we will not publish your book." So I kept trying to add scenes, and I got my brothers and sisters together, and I said, "Did Dad ever screw up and treat us nicely when we were growing up?" And I was very serious. And we would think, and, you know, we were seven of us then, and we'd think, and I'd think. And finally they came up, "No." I said, "You get us a hot dog?" "Nah." "Take us out for an ice cream cone?" "Nah." Take us to a ball game? Nah. We could not come up with anything. But Ann Barrett would not believe a guy was knocking us all over the place, hitting us, beating my mother to a pulp. She would not believe it. So I cut that out, and I made up stories that I'd like Dad to have done. He gives his son a flight jacket on his birthday. And I thought, what a nice thing that would have been. So I enjoyed writing that scene that never happened. Then his daughter goes to her first prom, and Dad has roses sent to the house. And so when later I asked Dad, did you like those scenes, Dad? Oh, God, I love those scenes. You know, what a great guy I was. And I said, Dad, I made them up. You didn't do any of it. Anything you did nice in the book, I invented. And you're absolutely right, and you're a very good reader. I had to tone it down to get it accepted at Houghton Mifflin.
Did you feel like with Prince of Tides, where the violence is much larger in Prince of Tides,
yes,
than it is in Death of Santini?
There's no question about it.
And it's almost, it's so interesting to read you, because it is like I'm reading a map, to read the books back to back, of kind of coming to terms, and this book, Death of Santini, is where you come to terms. And the thing that I would like to sit down and talk to you about all night is the idea that you wrote a nonfiction sequel to a novel.
Yes.
That just blows my mind. This is your best book. I mean, this is an astonishingly good book. It's compulsive. I couldn't stop. But it's almost like you're trying for the truth in fiction, and then you finally just say, to hell with it. I'm going to tell the truth.
I had trouble getting people. And it was, you know, my father's family denied it from the very beginning. And I've got to go to Chicago, and if I'm killed in Chicago...
Oh, if they haven't killed you by now, they...
I mean, but no, this one's going to be worse. You know, but it is these things that I thought life would get normal. I really did. I thought that, you know, you grew up in a family like mine, and life could get okay. Like when you told me the name of your new book, I thought, Ann Patch and I should travel around the world giving talks. When I heard that your book was How to Have a Beautiful Marriage, I'm thinking Conroy say, how to have a train wreck of a life. And we go around on the same stage. But my...
Sign me up.
my feeling was, if I could simply get this out of me, you know, that it had poisoned me, it had poisoned everything about me. How about I go through this violent childhood, then Dad chooses the Citadel for my rounding off, for my education. And I call my mother after the second week, and she answers the phone. Her voice, I break down, I start crying. And she said, how do you like college, son? And I said, oh, Mom, it's so wonderful. But it isn't a college. You send me to a torture chamber. And she said, well, it'll make a man out of you. A man. And she said, well, how bad can it be? And I said, here's how bad it is, Mom. It's worse than Dad. And my poor mother goes, oh, my God. What have we done? But it seemed to me to be a constant of, you know, turmoil that I brought this into the lives of the women I love, the children I love, the friends I've had. I've brought it everywhere. I've spread it out everywhere, and it has bothered me.
So do you think you're putting it to rest with this book?
Of course not. I will bring havoc. You know, I am worried that I will bring havoc unto my deathbed. The Conroys can't have a wedding, a funeral. We can't do anything normally. None of us. And these survivors, my brothers and sisters, are a gallant tribe. And, you know, I was worried about what they had to say about the book. Yeah. And one of my brothers read it, and he's the dark one, Jim. He calls me up, and I said, "How'd you like it, Jim?" And he said, "I think you've written an adequate book." My brother Mike, did you read the book? Yeah. Do you want to talk about it?
That's the one I hate.
You want to talk about it? Nah. So, you know, it's not like I'm getting a great literary...
Do you give them the book in manuscript or in galley?
I gave them in galley this time because of cowardice.
So you can't change it. Once they're seeing it, if
yes,
they say,
I can't change
listen, this
it.
Doesn't
yeah,
fly, yeah. It doesn't make any difference.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, what about the fact that by the time your dad dies at the end of Death of Santini, I feel bad. You teach me as a reader to care about him, to love him by the end of that book, more than you do your mom.
I knew I shouldn't come to Nashville.
I'm sorry. You know...
I understand. I understand. And it disturbed me also. My mother, I simply adored. She went crazy toward the end of her life, and that craziness, it really darkened some of my brother and sister's view of her.
Get your mic back up.
Huh?
You're losing
your mic. I'm so sorry. Because these are mean people that yell at me when they can't hear me. But, you know, with Dad, and there were things about Dad's death that were so moving. And Mom died at 59, and we did not get the chance to grow up enough to accept. Her death was just tragic and horrible. And Dad, we got a chance to see him, and his death was slow. We got to prepare for it. And when, you know, he was dying, you know, there were moments of what I thought were truly, you know, amazing incident. When you probably read this, when Dad was actually dying, we split time up with the six kids.
Right.
And, you know, 6-hour intervals. Because we wanted to give Dad a good death. We wanted to, you know, take care of Dad and make sure he was comfortable, make sure he knew he was loved, and all this stuff. And I came over, you know, for a morning shift, and I hear my sister Carol, who's a poet in New York, the most articulate, you know, of all of us. And I hear her screaming at Dad. And I walk inside, and Dad is he's gonna be dead in 3 days. I mean, it's soon. And Carol is screaming this, Ann. You gotta tell me you love me, Dad. You gotta tell me you love me. And she has tears streaming down her face. You gotta tell me you're proud of me, Dad. Proud of my life as a poet. You know, I've made a life as a poet, and it's been hard. It's been in New York City, and I've done it by myself. But you gotta tell me you love me, and you gotta tell me you're proud of me before you die. Now, this is moving to me as anything can be. So I go in, and of course, I'm the oldest of seven, and I was the protector, the lookout, the Rottweiler for the other kids. So I, as Carol said later, he wagged the finger of paternalism. And so I wagged it at her. She comes out, and she's just a wreck. And she's had a lifetime of mental illness. She's had a lifetime of estrangement from the family. And she comes out, and I said, Carol, it's very important for you to know something. Dad is dying. He's not going deaf. You don't have to scream at him. And Carol is a wreck. And she says, Pat, he's never told me he loves me in his whole life. He never told me he's proud of me his whole life. I've written poems. I've dedicated poems to Dad over and over again. I've done everything I could to make him proud of me. I've needed him my whole life just to tell me he loved me. And does he ever tell you that? And I said, Carol, to tell you the truth, every day the phone rings. And I pick it up and it's Dad. This has been going on for 30 years. And the phone rings and it's Dad on the phone. And I said, hey, Dad, how you doing? And he said, Pat, I just have to tell you this. I love you so much, I cannot even tell you or express it in words. And, Pat, I am so proud of your writing that it makes me want to fall to my knees in gratitude for the day that you were born. And I only wish I could feel the same way about Carol. Which is the perverted Conroy humor.
Okay, and finish that story, because the punchline of okay, your brother-in-law, okay. That's...
You've read the book, and that's cheating. Nobody reads a book on a tour. So I said, Carol, I'm joking. Dad cannot tell us he loves us. He cannot tell us, you know, he's proud of us. It's the great Santini dying in there. It's not Bill Cosby, okay? We know that. We got to learn how to translate Dad. And, you know, the translation is, it isn't that hard. Dad has tried to show us he's loved us in his own way. Well, I get Carol to come back in. So we are sitting there, and my redneck brother-in-law, Bobby Joe. Now, I ain't got to explain to no Tennessee audience what a redneck is, okay? But when I tell you Bobby Joe makes your relatives look like Rockefellers, and you cannot figure out who your brothers and sisters are going to marry. That is part of life, is most difficult. Bobby Joe comes in and is redneck as they come, and he looks over at my father and he goes, hey, old man, how you feeling? Dad would be dead in 2.5 days. I hear him say in a weakened voice, I love you, Bobby Joe. I'm proud of you, Bobby Joe. And my sister goes off like a Roman candle, and she goes for his throat with both hands, and both of us have to pull Carol off my dying father. Now, Ann, see, you know, I imagine, and I don't know, that when your parents die, it's sort of like, oh my Lord. And your mother looks up to you and literature, fame, loveliness, class, not my family. When Dad gets buried 2 days later, okay, you know, weddings, not in a Conroy family, it can't go well. We drive up with Dad's body. He has suffered greatly. He's died well. We're driving up in all the hearses. There's a million of us. My sister Carol, the poet, leaps out of the hearse before it stops. She leaps out. We have no idea what she's doing. She races through the church and goes up to the thing. She's going to read a poem. So she lines up water. She's lining up stuff. Well, we walk in later. Carol, meanwhile, comes down and sits beside Dad's coffin. All right, that means everyone has to cross over. Carol, with our behinds, crossing Carol's face to get over. So Carol says, I must hold my father's coffin. I was closer than anyone to my father. No one loved a father the way a poet can love. No one possible in this family could know how a poet feels. And then she would look at me, especially not a prose writer. And so I end up and I crawl over Carol, and we're used to Carol, you know, we're used to something. So the things start. Now, my Uncle Jim, a priest in Chicago, Dad's brother, he does a ceremony. So it all starts, and it's going to be a solemn high mass in honor of the great Santini. Okay, in Catholic Church, that's big stuff. The mass is going on for about 5 minutes when I get a note from somebody, and I've never received a note at the funeral of my father. So this is, you know, I'm a little curious, but I look down, and we have a thing that I'm looking at of how the things of the ceremony is going to go. I'm going to read a eulogy, and first Carol is going to read a poem, and I get this note that says, "Pat, I have decided that poetry is a higher form of art than prose." I come thinking, oh, I can't quite have this argument here. And she said, "You give your prose eulogy for Dad, and I am not going to let these jumbo priests tell me when to give my poem. I will read it after the ceremony is over and all the religious mumbo-jumbo is finished." Okay, I'm sitting there. Dad's died. And I say, there are now two people in this church that know that Carol is not going to read her poem when it says so on. So there's a part of me that I admit and I hate in myself that my brother and sister call the Santini part. And everyone, I try to keep it down. I promise y'all, I try to keep this buried deep within me. It comes out at this moment. So I rise up like a troll under the bridge.
Oh, you're scaring me. Stop that.
And I look at Carol and I say, "Hey, Carol, give me a break." And then I wheel around. Now, it's a Conroy thing. Everybody accuses me of exaggerating. I think I'm a shy minimalist. What happened next, it doesn't happen to anybody but a Conroy. I turn my back. I am enraged, red-faced, horrified. I'm about to beat Carol up in, you know, over my father's casket, you know, just beating her to a pulp. When I turn around, my brother said later, "Pat, you missed it." Carol went down on one knee in the pew. Okay, translation time again, ladies and gentlemen. She goes down on one knee, and there is a common expletive in our language, never heard in Nashville, Tennessee, because of religious nature of the city, but the first word begins with F, and the second word begins with Y. Carol goes down into a crouch and begins shooting me the bird. And she's shooting me the bird, saying the F-U word out loud. And so later I said, how many birds did she shoot me? The lowest number was 50. The highest number was 200. I said, did anybody hear or see her? And my sister Kathy, thinking she'd make me feel better, said, only about three quarters of the church saw it. But Anne, this is the kind of thing that, you know, that haunts me and follows me and hunts me down, whether I want to or not.
This is so confusing, though, and this is your brilliance. You're making us laugh. You're making us laugh. I laughed my head off through this book, and it is a tragedy. I mean, it's the saddest book in the world, and I was gasping. I was laughing so hard.
See, Anne, you know, I cannot... tell you, these are horrible stories. You know, when my brother, I had a brother commit suicide, it's the worst thing that's ever happened to us. He was the youngest brother, he was a paranoid schizophrenic. He leaps off a building, 14-story building, in Columbia, South Carolina, and he is a disaster, Ian. I mean, we have to bury him almost the next day, because it's the middle of August, and his head is just, everything has come apart. And they scrape him up. And we've got to get this thing together. And my father, you know, and Dad, you know, he gets on the phone. I said, Dad, are you okay? And my father, again, is crying so hard. And he says to me, and this nearly broke my heart, Ann. He says, Pat, I lost my baby boy. You don't know what it's like to lose your baby. And I remember Tom, you know, when he first was born. And I remember milking and giving him milk at night. And, you know, I remember holding him because he was a sickly child. And I'd walk the floor all night with Tom. And so, Dad, we get down there. We have another funeral, and everybody says, oh, God, what is going to happen now? But what could happen? So I get to the funeral. Carol realizes she's not a pallbearer, and she screams at us, you, my sexist pig brothers, my horrible patriarchal brothers, women, you hate us all. You despise us all. You know, why do you do this to women? Okay. You know, we can't get... Good gosh, Carol, let's discuss feminism before we get Tom into the grave. And she says, I will be the one, the head pallbearer. Poor Bobby Joe, the redneck, gets kicked off. And she says, my shrink, Naoko, has told me that the Conroys are a toxic family and I should have nothing to do with them. I said, oh, Naoko, what a genius. I've made millions of dollars off the fact that we do have a toxic family. So we go in and she says, I will not sit with my family. I will sit with the pallbearers. All right, I sit by Dad during the whole thing. He's broken. He is a broken man, Ann Patch. It is pathetic. He is crying so hard doing this. I'm squeezing his shoulders. I'm doing everything we can. My youngest sister's wiping his face, tears streaming down. Now, Uncle Jim, my priest, Dad's brother, comes out. And he looks down and he says, today, ladies and gentlemen, we have gathered together in celebration of the life and death, and he looks down and he says, Timothy Conroy. Tom killed himself. Tim was sitting behind me. So I lean back and I say, Tim. I'm so sorry you're dead. I heard it was Tom. Okay, and meanwhile, my sister Carol has been crying so hard, and Carol keeps telling us, Ann, the whole time over, Tom was the only sane member of the Conroy family. He's the only one that was sane. If we were sane, we would all do what Tom did, and we would all have held hands and jumped together. I'm thinking seven kids leaping from a building in Columbia in a daisy chain. This is going to be... So anyway, Carol has collected tissue, and it's disgusting. When she got there from New York, it's tennis ball size. So I said, Carol, and I bring over a trash can, would you like to put this in? No, my tears to Tom are sacred to me. These are a poet's tears. This is a poet's grief. Now, Anne, make up a scene like this for fiction, okay?
No, thank you, no.
Okay.
Yeah, wouldn't touch it.
Just make one up for me.
Wouldn't touch it.
Okay, so I'm looking, she says, my grief, my poet's grief is contained in this ball of tissue, which I shall hold sick. All right, we get there. We have 2 days of the funeral. It's building. It is building. Okay, Carol announces to everybody, we cannot tell anybody that Tom had a mental illness. If anybody says this, I will scream, I will choke them, I will murder them in the church. My poor uncle is still up there talking about my brother Tim's suicide. And he said, now Tim was a good boy, although he did have quite a few mental problems. Okay, I'm looking across. Now, the town has come out, you know, for Tom. It's very nice. And when he said mental problems, I see that it's now the size of a softball. I see that tissue hurled up into the air. So I look around, I see my brothers and sisters going... And my brother Jim goes nuts, and he says, who's throwing a damn softball during Tom's funeral? So, and I'm saying, I said, Jim, relax, we'll get through this, don't worry about this. And poor Uncle Jim is going through, and he said, and Tom went to the University of Southern Colorado and did very... University of South Carolina.
And he got the initials right.
And we go through this, and then he comes back and he says, well, in my parish in Davenport, Iowa, every day I feed the poor and the mentally ill. Okay, this thing goes up this time twice as high. And I see... It's a longer arc of people looking, watching it come down. All right, I'm praying for this funeral to be over by this time. Carol gets up to read a poem, man. It's a lovely poem. It's a beautiful poem. She's a great poet. She reads the poem, but of course she's irritated the family by then. My brother Jim announces to the family as she's walking down, I know why Tom killed himself now. He always hated crappy poetry. The priest comes back up. Dad is crying. He's weeping so hard. The priest comes back up and he says, even my brother Jim, or brother Jack, is a paranoid schizophrenic and has the worst mental illness I've ever seen. With this, the final heave, and it nearly hits the roof. It goes up, and I look back to the audience, and the entire audience in Beaufort is going... A year ago in Publix in Beaufort, a lady stopped me and says, Pat, this has always been too personal. But could you tell me who was throwing the softball during Tom's funeral?
Do you realize once this book comes out, no one's ever going to put that on the front of a sentence? No one's ever going to say to you again, Pat, this might be too personal. Okay. I got, you know, I'm like on the second card here. I got a lot of really good questions. One, in this book where you are so honest, so hard on everyone and especially on yourself, and you turn your own sins over before anyone else's, the omission is Prince of Tides. That's kind of like, that's been edited out. Talk about that. Okay. Because, boy, Carol, I think Carol is really pissed off about the Prince of Tides.
Okay. I, of course, would not have used language so obscene.
I live here.
A religious
city. I can say that. Yeah. Sorry.
As Nashville.
Sorry.
That's quite all right.
I'm in a high school, too. Sorry.
Carol was enraged
yeah.
by the Prince of Tides. And I did not see why. And I said, Carol, if you reread The Prince of Tides, I have you as a great poet. I have you as an honored poet. I have you a poet who is famous in New York City. Also, to protect myself, I made sure that you were in a coma for the entire book. And I thought this would lead to some protection. And Carol always has this thing, and it's a legitimate argument. And I would love to see Carol write a book giving her side of this story. I would pay for that book. I would love to read it. Because when I tell you she's smart, when I tell you she's talented, when I tell you she's gifted, it's more than that. She was the most precocious kid I'd ever met in my life. I mean, I just was... this little kid marveling at this. She was 5 years old. The same girl from The Prince of Tides. 5 years old, comes up to me and says, Pat, I've noticed something. I said, what's that, Carol? And she always seemed older than me. I said, what's that, Carol? And she said, our parents are nuts. I said, oh, and, I was seven. I said, oh, not mommy and daddy. And I did all the stuff, a seven-year-old boy would do. And she said, nah, I've looked at television. I've looked at Father Knows Best. And I've looked at all these things, Leave It to Beaver. And she said, you see the way they treat each other? I mean, they're nice to each other, nice to their kids. You know, you don't see your mother flying through a plate glass window at the end of an evening. And she said, you watch. They're going to turn out to be nuts. Then she said something else. It's going to hurt us. And she was perfectly right. And The Prince of Tides, it pained me because, she said she wouldn't read it. You know, her friends, she has big shot friends in Atlanta, in New York, that wrote me the meanest letters, you've ever heard. But I've always been afraid to talk about The Prince of Tides. One, because it was the most successful book I'll ever have. And
this one might be.
I mean, it
you
just,
might outdo
it,
yourself.
But I mean, it is, in success in my family, is you're not supposed to act like you're successful at all. And when I go up to Chicago, there will be the Chicago relatives in line. I have a 300-pound nun, Sister Marge, will be there. And she'll be in the back of the line. She'll say, here's what you get. In a normal life, and this happens to me every time I go to Chicago, I don't never tell them I'm coming. And they find out, and Sister Marge, I'll hear her voice, and she'll say, hey, Patty boy, it's your virgin aunt. And
there's an image for you, huh?
And they just all seemed mean to me when I was growing up. My southern relatives seemed like the nicest people on earth. And I never saw the Chicago people. Uncle Jim, who thought Tim had killed himself, could not pick us up out of a police lineup. He had no idea who we were. But The Prince of Tides has always been both a glory in my soul and a great wound, because I don't think I would have written it if Mom had been alive.
Well, that's an interesting thing to think about, because what if you had written a version of this book first? What if you had just told the truth about your childhood first? What would that have done to you as a writer, as a novelist?
Okay, here's what would have happened, and I can answer this honestly, Anne. Father Jim is at the podium. We have come here to celebrate the life and death of Pat Conroy. He was killed by my brother, who is now in federal penitentiary, in a fit of rage. I could not have done it when I was younger. I was still too full of denial. I had to go through therapy. I had to find out things about myself I did not know. I'd have to find out things about myself I hated. And I couldn't have written it then.
Years ago, I was having lunch with Dorothy Allison, and she was trying to write a book after Bastard Out of Carolina. And she said to me, "I'm afraid that I only have one story to tell." And at that moment, I realized that I only had one story to tell, and that probably everybody only has one story to tell. So if you've got one story and you feel like this time, you know, you've been kind of coming at it from a lot of different angles, and this time you went straight down into the middle and blew it apart, where does that leave you now?
Well, here's where it leaves me. I've always wanted to write...
Microphone. Here's where it leaves me.
I think to be corrected by Ann Patchett is a beautiful thing.
Only because we want to hear you.
I understand. I'm kidding you. Here's where it leaves me. I've always wanted to write an Atlanta novel, because there's not many of them.
No. There's one really big one.
And I think there's one. I just think these cities. I look around Nashville and I, yes, indeed.
We could use a Pat Conroy Nashville novel.
My Nashville, the only time I've been to Nashville is I wrote a novel about what I know would be the sexual innuendo of Ingram books and the wild and unspeakable women that I have met out there in the various books of my career.
We'll talk about some that of them backstage. Are here tonight. Yeah, that'll be entre nous. So what next?
You know, I think
now you've done this. Now you've done the thing
right.
That you've been angling around.
And there's and here's what I worry about now. I heard this conversation. My children are now terrified.
That you're coming after their stories?
Yeah, and I haven't written my children yet. And I said,
"Wow,
do you remember your teenage years, girls?"
Wow.
And I used to tell my girls, I said, "Girls, okay, I'm not going to be very tough on you. I would like each one of you to date a guy I don't hate." That's the only thing. The only rule I have. But there's so much to write about, the friends you make. You know, there's a literary life. I haven't lived a very, you know, active one. But, you know, it's interesting to me. You know, people getting together, writing books, conceiving books, making careers. And as you know, it's hard to make a career. It's hard to make a career out of what you do, and you love what you do. And you know, so there's in friends that I've made along the way.
Yeah.
Their lives, I'd love to write about some of those friends. Some of them, I would love to destroy their lives as they are living it right now. But you
and
know,
man, you could do it.
I find life goes on and keeps giving you material over and over again.
Thinking about what you just said about writing or not writing about your children, you have said rather famously, and no doubt this will be the quote that will dog you all through book tour, that you don't believe in happy families. You know, if somebody says to you, I had a happy family, you'll say, give me an hour and I'll take it apart. So do you believe in happy people, happy marriages, happy childhoods?
I believe there's been one happy marriage in America thus far. And I'm about to read about it in your new book.
It is actually good.
It sounds cynical, and I know this, but you know when that story first came up was when this beautiful couple came up to me, and I think it was in Atlanta. I think it was in Riches, and y'all know the type. Okay, take the handsomest fraternity boy, K.A. at Vanderbilt. You know, take the tri-delt, the prettiest tri-delt girl, looking something like Ann Patchett, okay? Give me a break. Take this couple, and they come up to me in Atlanta. The Prince of Tides has just come out, Ann. And they said, the guy says, and, you know, the guy had this, you know, I just made Ann's husband. He had this Swanee-like arrogance to him, you know, this. And he comes up and he says, hey, Pat, your family's crazy, aren't they? And I said, yeah, they're kind of crazy. So I said, how's your family? My family's great. Now, you think about in this audience what you would say to me. Oh, my family's great. My family's wonderful. My family's fabulous. My family's perfect, this guy said. And I said, okay, pal, let's be honest. How far do I have to go to find the first crazy in your family? And please play this game along with me. Dad, mom, uncle, aunt, brother, sister. Now, usually, you know, we hit pay dirt somewhere in here. But this poor, pretty woman, this poor tri-delt, breaks. And as I'm going through this little litany, she finally explodes and she says, his mother's nuts! And I know there are families that are not like this, you know, because I've seen them. You know, I've met them. But I think what families who are happy can do is they have much better coping mechanisms than my family ever had. They have ways to get over things. They have ways to argue which are healthy. Instead of, you know, blood flying across the room, they have developed ways to make themselves, if not, you know, deliriously happy, content, and perfectly content in what they have.
But you said in the middle of this interview, you said, when my father was dying, the six of us worked out shifts, so we would all be there because we loved him and we wanted him to be comfortable. Why?
Well, we had some moments where Dad would yell at us during that.
But you loved him and you wanted him to be comfortable.
Yeah, we did. Mike broke once during taking care of him. You know, Mike had forgotten to get him a morphine pill. And Dad was hurting. And well, Mike was fumbling. Dad was cussing Mike. And Mike, before he gives him the morphine pill, goes over and he says, that's what you get for beating Mom and the kids when we were small. Now do you want the morphine, Dad? So Dad, of course, said yes. But you know, basically, we had come to love the guy.
You did.
We did.
So did we. You know, that's what you did to the readers. It's because you have compassion. And what you impart to us is your compassion, which is what beams out of you here and in everything you write. You have compassion for all of us. A lot of people don't, you know? And to me, That is a real version of happiness, to be able to look at someone and say, I see you completely for what you are and what you've done, and I still want to be there when you die. I still want to hold you. I still am going to love you. That's a version of happiness that is profound. And that's what you really get in this book. Which is why we're going to end here, and you're all going to line up and buy it. And you're going to get signed copies for your friends for Christmas. It's a brilliant achievement. I'm proud to know you.
Thank you very much.